Today, the shocking truth about wealth management platforms. Hello again, it's Miles North from Digital Finance Analytics, World's latest post covering finance and property news. Now I'm joined today by Damian Klassen, Head of Investments at Nucleus Wealth and Walk the Wealth Fund. And Damian, we're going to have a very important conversation about these things called wealth management platforms, because actually there are some guilty secrets that we need to expose.
Yeah, absolutely. So we operate on a number of them. I've spoken to, talking to all the big players and sort of evaluated what they do, and so yeah, so relatively up to speed with all the different platforms and where some of their tips and their tricks and what they're hiding.
Yeah, and it's worth just reflecting on this idea of a platform, because effectively, actually, this was an idea that evolved quite early in Australia and then has spread around to many other countries as well. And it's where most people have access to some information about their investment portfolios, whether it's a superannuation fund or whether it's one in your own name. But there are quite a few different ones, and they're not all the same. They are actually, some are transparent, some are lesser transparent. But there are also some bigger questions about what they're really telling you and who are they really for.
Yeah, that's right. Because I think the first is probably worth giving a quick overview of, like, what is a platform? What are they doing? And what else is out there in terms of what you can do? So the thing is, there's stockbrokers out there, and they're basically doing the trades for you. They can hold the securities on your behalf, and there's sort of relatively little sort of portfolio administration. So you go to a CommSec or any of the sort of bigger brokers out there, and they can do the trading for you and hold those. What the platforms then are doing is they're managing a whole bunch of things, whether it's cash settlements, access to bank accounts, tax records, corporate actions, advisor access is a big one. Like, a lot of the platforms is really based around making things easier for your advisor. So that's sort of, they sort of sit in the whole, but doing a whole bunch of things in the middle, and fee collection as well is important, I suppose. That's probably the big thing they do. At the other end, you sort of got the investment managers and advisors, and they're the ones sort of doing the portfolio construction and rebalancing and everything like that. And then, so they sort of interact with these platforms, and then you get the, and then the platforms will do the trading somewhere. You've got the unlisted things. So, and usually what happens is the unlisted, they're sort of like each one's like its own little mini platform doing all the tax and everything within it. And then the question is, with those unlisted ones, do you deal with them directly, or do you stick them on a platform, which makes it very convenient for you, but then there's a cost to having, they're going to charge you a rate for having your funds on there.
Yeah, and one of the reasons why it's pushed quite hard is it gives you flexibility, because you can actually dip in and dip out of different investment asset classes in theory. Mm. In theory, it shows you what your balances are and how they're performing. And in theory, it shows the fees that are being charged, except, of course, it's always more complicated when you start looking at it. But, of course, if you go to something like an ETF, and an ETF is then plugged into your platform, there's a whole set of other fees and charges and activity over in the ETF fund that doesn't actually necessarily get reported in your wealth management reporting. No. So it gets complicated. And I'll tell you, the thing that I get more cross about than anything else is all of the clipping the tickets that go along through these processes, right? And I find that very often people have no idea what it's really costing to do what they're wanting to do.
Yeah, exactly. And we sort of talk about this with me, well, on our website, as we show different fees for clients, say, okay, this is what our fee is. We sort of have to break it down to go, well, if you're comparing us to a managed fund, you should be thinking about this fee. If you're comparing us to a platform, to a ETF, you should be thinking about this different fee. If you're comparing us to an advisor or something like that, okay, you should be thinking about these fees, because everyone's got these different levels of fees that they have to report and they don't have to report. And so it can be really tricky. And ASIC tries to make it obvious for everyone, but it's just that it is complicated, and whatever gaps they leave, you can be absolutely sure that that's where everyone's going to be like, oh, they've left a gap over there. That's where I'm going to be charging fees. And so so some of the ones, one of the most common ones, and the ones I see that I hate, is this whole foreign exchange, because that one just really can screw you on in ways you just never imagine. There's all these people out there talk about, oh, fee-free, there's no cost to trade US shares or something like that. And it's like, yeah, they don't charge you anything on the actual transaction to buy you the shares, because they're screwing you so badly on the foreign exchange rates that they don't need to. And some of these guys will charge, 0.75% or something like that on exchange rates. And so, you and some of them also won't even keep the money. So you go and buy a US share, and you buy Nvidia, and then you decide, oh no, now I want Apple. And so they sell your Nvidia share, convert the money back into Aussie dollars, and then the next day you go buy me Apple. And then they're like, oh, okay, back and bought Apple. And he's just been, I've just paid 1.5% jumping back and jumping forth again just before, and for my free trades, And so that's a sort of an insidious one. And the cash balance as well. Look, it's sort of, I don't know. Look, banks get you on that all the time anyway. So you should be used to that in Australia. But the investment platforms take a reasonable cut of it, and we'll usually charge, one or two, sorry, we usually pay you 1 or 2% below what they're earning, and just take the margin as a or as profit. Yeah. And so that sort of gets hidden a bit. You don't see that as a fee. What else was there? Well, actually, I can keep going through all these, but I think that might be the rest of the one. I'll do a couple of really quick ones though that I see all the time. A lot of the time when people are on platforms, you will have an advisor. And if you have an advisor, there's a rule now that basically says every year, the advisor needs to come back and get your explicit permission to keep charging their advice fee. And the advice fee might be, 0.3, 0.4%, whatever it is. And they need to get you to sign off on that. And so they make this big deal about, hey, here is your fee, and here is exactly the amount you're going to be charged for this, and sign down here and all that type of stuff. And it's one of these, be careful what you wish for type things from ASIC. Is they wanted to make this really clear to people, hey, you're paying for advice, and here's what the fee is. But because this is the only thing people see every year about their fees, they look at it and they go, oh, 0.4%, that's pretty good. And we quite often get people sort of talking about this and going, no, that's not your fee. That's just the tip of the your iceberg. Below that, you've go, now you've got your platform. That's your advisor fee. Then you've got your platform fee. Then you've got your investment fees. Then you might have some sort of performance fees on those as well. Then you've got transactions fees. And then there's these embedded fees that sort of sit within these underlying funds that you miss out on as well. And so, there's multiple levels. We sort of talk about six levels that you need to look at for fees to try and work out, what the right levels, what you're actually paying in terms of the fees.
Right. And it gets very complicated because, of course, you can offset some fees in your tax return, but not necessarily other fees, right? Depending on it precisely the way that it's done and what they're called and all of those things. And then the other interesting observation about the fee structures is that if you transact more, you're probably going to generate more fees than if you transact less. And there are sometimes incentives for people to push you to transact and keep transacting and transacting again. And if people are actively managing their own portfolios, they probably will want to move different asset blocks around quite often. But there are costs involved in doing that, in addition to that advice fee or the platform fee.
Yeah, well, there's two parts to this. One is there's a brokerage fee within most places, and that brokerage fee will just add up over time. And especially if you're doing, smaller trades, we'll just add to that brokerage fee. So depending upon your size, you really want to try and focus. For example, we've got platforms where one of the main platforms we use, and there's no minimum. So we sort of bundle up all the trades together ourselves, and then charge one sort of percentage fee. So there's not sort of, you don't have to worry about, oh, I'm buying, I've got $100 that's just dropped into my account. On ours, we go out and buy 50 shares for them and charge them, a few cents to do the trade across everything. But if you've got $100 coming in, and you're on a platform that charges a minimum of, even something quite low, minimum $3 for a trade, is you're like, well, just a minute, I've just paid three, I've lost 3% before I even started, like, and on this. And so I don't want to reinvest money sort of on a regular basis. I just want to hold up until I've got like $1,000 or a couple of thousand dollars so that I can get that initial investment down. And so, yeah, finding platforms that sort of suits the size of your investments is important. And there's this idea about, well, it's called cash drag. And it's basically if you're not if you always have sort of 5% cash sitting on the sideline because you're waiting to have enough cash to then go buy some more, is it that's going to be a drag on your performance over the time. You're going to be earning 5% less per annum than what you might have done because it's just sitting there in cash. And that's that, over the long term, that really starts to add up. So there's that part. And the other one, which people ignore because it's not, the platforms won't show you this, is the tax consequence if you're out there trading a lot. So, if you're with a, stockbrokers make money from people trading, and so they will encourage people to trade. And the thing with that, though, is every time you take a capital gain, you're paying tax on it. And so, the idea that buy and hold and try and that whole idea of compounding, if you can have a, if, especially if you're on the top tax bracket, if I can be earning a return of 15%, but I'm paying 47 cents in the dollar and I'm realizing it every year, and so I'm actually only earning an 8% return, and somebody else is sitting there with a fund that's only doing 10% per annum, but it's not trading all the time. It's just sitting, buying and holding, and it's passive assets and things like that. Is that those types of ones are going to end up outperforming you on an after-tax basis, even though you might have these really high headline figures. And so, that's a real genuine cost of that, of too much trading.
Now, one other question which is worth reflecting on, whose name is the money sitting in, right? Because there are some different structures, and in some cases it's in your own name, in some cases it's not necessarily really within your own name at all.
No, that's right. So I think there's. So I'd sort of picture this as three different sort of levels of this. So one is the level of a managed fund or an exchange traded fund or some sort of pooled investment. So basically, what's happening there is you're sticking your money in. They're just treating you as the same as everyone else, and so all your money gets mixed up with theirs, and whatever happens. So let's say I'm investing in a managed fund, and I'm sticking in $1,000 a month into that fund. And my money keeps coming in and they're out buying shares, but somebody's drawing a pension from that, and maybe they're taking $1,000 out every month. Is that this fund might be doing transactions because they're like, oh, Damien just asked for another, just put another $1,000 in, let's go buy some Nvidia shares. And then, oh, Bill just wants to take his money out, let's go sell the Nvidia shares. And the thing is, there's capital gains associated with those. And so what's happening is we're sort of realizing the capital gains, or as a fund is realizing capital gains and sharing it amongst everyone who's out there. So even though I'm actually just investing into that fund and not putting anything new in, I'm still getting capital gains because of what other people are doing within the fund. And there's this idea behind some investors who, some of the sort of institutional top investors who are basically looking for the funds that are growing their fund quite quickly because you're sort of, you're getting in front of those capital gains. Whereas if you're coming back the other way and the fund's shrinking, then all of a sudden they're realizing all these capital gains and the people who are left in there are ending up paying, capital gains they probably didn't want to pay. And so there's a genuine drag within that, with that. Okay, so that's your managed fund structure. Then you've got what you call a managed account. And so, which is what we do exclusively. And there's a couple of different versions of this. There's separately managed accounts and managed discretionary accounts, but there's a legal structure difference. But the actual end product is you own shares that are held in custody on your behalf. And so the shares are yours. You can have fractional shares within that. So that makes it really handy in that you can buy part of a share. So you want to buy, I don't know, Rheinmetall, which is a German defense company that's making all this money from all the from switching across as Trump sort of drawing away from Europe. And they might cost you, in terms of Australian dollars, $2,500 a share. And so it means that if you're putting money in and gradually growing, is that you can just buy 0.1 of a share or 0.1 of a share, if that's sort of part of that, that's how much it was going to make up a part of your portfolio. Okay, so you've got that structure. The issue with those that some people have is the idea of custody, and a lot of, it's a very Australian thing, is that there's a lot of Australian investments that get held under what's called a HIN, and that means it's directly in your name, held, everything's held in your name. And so the idea the idea that's pushed by some Australian platforms is, oh, it's got to be in a HIN. Everything's, it's not safe unless it's in a HIN. Now, that's something that, the rest of the world doesn't understand because they don't have the same structure. The rest of the world, 80, 90% of all the shares are all held in custody. It's a pretty safe structure. What it does allow as well is it does allow that all the dividend notices and all the, do you want to, the capital raises, corporate actions, all that type of stuff can be all dealt with by your broker or on the platform. Whereas if you're the HIN, you're the one getting all these emails and dividend notices and all that type of stuff is coming directly to you if it's all held on HIN. So between those two, look, there is a little bit of a difference. There's no real cost difference. The cost is so small. Most platforms don't charge that custody fee. They just work it into their trading costs. And even that, when it is explicit, it's a very, very small fee in terms of the overall. It's like measured in fractions of a percent in terms of how low they are. So, for me, I certainly don't have any issue holding stuff in custody, and I think there's some real benefits to it. But yeah, that's your sort of three options for how it's held.
But the point there is, if you actually have it held in the custody model, they can provide a more complete picture for the reporting and tax, right? Whereas if you've actually
Yes.
got it on individual HINs, you could end up with having to do more work yourself from a tax reporting perspective.
Yeah, that's right. The cost of doing of sending it to your accountant and your accountant sort of plugging them all in as well. So, I mean, that is another benefit of a lot of the platforms. A lot of stockbroking platforms have that as well, is where you can just plug your accountant straight into it. And so that's certainly an option across all the platforms we deal with. The big accounting firms or most accounting firms, will have software that will plug directly into this platform and pull out all the data that they need, and so that nobody's sort of typing stuff in anymore.
So one other question to think about is whether you want to make trades yourself on the platform or whether you want your advisor or somebody else to make the trades for you, right? Because that actually is functionally quite different.
Yeah, so it's a lot that's about the reinvestment side, and depending upon your idea of what you want to do in terms of being diversified. But for us, we tend to hold the underlying stocks directly, and what that means is we might have portfolios of 100 odd stocks within that, which means some of them paying quarterly dividends, some of them paying monthly dividends. Most are paying either half yearly or annual dividends. It just means there's a lot of dividends coming through and a lot of things happening at all times, and there's fees coming in, there's interest payments and all these things happening, is about saying, well, it's on a platform. The platform can actually manage that for you in terms of saying, well, just go and reinvest it back in the same stocks, or go and reinvest it back into the portfolio that you want. And so from managing that, as long as the fees aren't too high on those, I spoke before about the minimum fee sizes. But yeah, for some, as long as it's done well, it just means that $100 worth of dividends comes in, and on one of our platforms, if we've reinvested that, there's like nine. We might go out and buy 10 shares for you and charge you 9 cents on the entire trade. And so that's that type of, that's where it works really well. If you don't have your settings right, and you've done that same thing I spoke about the example before, where it's out buying 10 different stocks and it's doing a minimum $3 per trade, and next thing you know, you've $100 in, $30 is gone from trading costs. And so they can definitely do it, but it is important to manage that process and make sure you've got the right dollar amounts sort of for what's you're not paying too much in those ongoing costs.
And I think the other thing that's worth highlighting, of course, there are some regulatory environments within which the platforms work. So they have some obligations, both in terms of reporting, but also in terms of the way that they're governed to try and safeguard people's money. So far, the platform environment in Australia has looked pretty stable.
Yeah. So they've certainly, a few of them have copped it over this whole Shield Guardian
Yes.
issue, and so that's certainly making a doing the rounds. I think in the end for that one, I mean that's actually interesting in itself to see that these platforms are actually being said, well, why did you have this and why did you let people put money into it? You should have done more about making sure that was right. Now, that's which is an interesting, in some ways you go, yeah, that's good for ASIC's doing that, but in other ways it's like, well, just a minute, whose job is it to regulate
Yes.
these funds? Isn't that your job? Aren't you the ones who are meant to be? And so you're blaming these guys for and so yeah, there's definitely that sort of there is more regulatory oversight than certainly than what the platforms would want. And they do have to sort of try and make sure that things that are going on there are genuinely, real assets that have sort of got real people behind them and sort of aren't being made up. Whereas, if you're doing things directly yourself, you don't have that safeguard. Yeah. If you go and you're not investing in Shield Guardian over a platform, you're just going direct. Now you've lost that extra layer of people looking at things for you.
Absolutely. And of course, the point there is that the platforms like to show a nice wide range of different investment options for you to choose from. The question is, have they done sufficient due diligence to be able to show that the things on the platforms are fit and appropriate to be invested in? That's the big open question, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. And it's this whole it's an ongoing issue of who deserves to pay for all this stuff. I mean, one of the things we're copying at the moment is, and a lot of compl a lot of advisors are all complaining about this, but there's basically the we're effectively paying for the people who lost the money in Shield through industry levies. They're basically saying, well, yeah, there were some bad actors out there, and they stuffed up. And so anyone who was doing the right thing, you guys got to pay for the losses of these people who went to the bad guys. And you're like, just well, I don't completely understand where. Obviously, we have to pay it. We have to pay it. It's, but it's a direct linking of sort of. It feels a bit like Martin saying, look, one of your neighbors just got robbed because they leave the door open and didn't have any locks on it. Guess what, Martin? All the neighbors have to chip in to cover the losses on his house. And you're like, well, just a minute. I had my locks on and I had an alarm, Anyway, there's
Yes.
definitely lots of that stuff going on.
Another reason that's probably going to get more significant because, again, there's greater complexity and complexity of products and things like that. But the point I want to sort of come to, Damien, is sure, there are lots of different platforms out there, but they're not all the same in terms of transparency, disclosure, fees, accessibility, and a bunch of other things too. So, how do you sort of navigate this and how do you settle on the right platform for you?
Yeah, well, getting to the bottom of the fees. So the sixth level of fees, you got to look at the administration fees. So that will be usually relatively obvious for most of these in terms of that. What the investment fees are, but below that. So when you're investing in the funds, what are the fee you're paying within that? The advice fee that sort of sits on top of that as well. Performance fees that sit either at the advice or at the investment level. Transaction fees that every time you're trading, what are those transactions? Now, the track transactions will often be hidden, and especially when you won't see those on your annual statement because you buy BHP for $100, they charge you a dollar for it. You've it's recorded as you paying $101 to get $100 worth of shares. And then the embedded fees below that, which is the what exchange traded funds or some of the managed funds that you're buying. And again, they won't show those. That's in the price. It's like, well, because I bought this thing for $50 and it had a 1% fee, so that meant they charged me, 5 cents. And so now it's not, yeah, now it's worth $49.95. And so you don't see that as a fee. You just see that the share price of that hasn't moved as much as what you wanted it to. And so yeah, so that's your sort of your levels of fees you're looking at. The other thing then to remember is, you're not the real customer of these funds. The real customer is the financial advisors usually. And so the idea is that most platforms are out there to make the job of financial advisors easier. And if they can make their job easier and bring all these assets together and put them all onto a platform, then so it's that question about when you look at what advisors can do and how this sort of they make their life easier. And then it's really being charged back though to clients in the end. And then the question is, well, Do I need to pay for all this stuff that makes your life easier? Or would I prefer to have it on a platform that makes my life easier and is cheaper? And so I think that's probably the key one I'd be looking at is, is especially if they're looking to change platforms for you, an advisor looking to change platforms is this really what I want, or is this just making their life easier from a administration point of view?
And just one other question that people might be thinking about. Okay, I've got some superannuation and I pay that into superannuation. So my superannuation fund has a platform. I may have another investment portfolio somewhere else. I may have another platform. So I end up with multiple platforms as different parts of my investment, which means I've still got a problem of trying to pull it all together.
Yeah, absolutely. And see an overall view of the different things you own is very difficult. So, and it's worth keeping in mind. So there's sort of three different levels of superannuation that I think you should be thinking about. One is there's a superannuation fund. It's that pooled asset, your Australian supers or Australian retirement trusts, where you're putting money in, they're putting into one big bucket with everyone else. That's effectively what you're getting within those. Then there's the managed accounts version of it. And that's so if you came to, say, Nucleus or someone similar, what we'll do is it's still a superannuation fund. You don't need an SMSF or anything, but you get to own the individual shares. And so it gets managed by somebody, that's us, and sits with a superannuation provider like a Diversa or Equity Trustees or someone like that who's actually the superannuation fund behind it. But they're just letting a fund manager pull the levers for you. And then the third one is you go to your self-managed super fund and you go and invest money directly yourself. And so what we find is that if you're at that third level of self-managed super fund, well, you're probably saving yourself, I don't know, $1,000, $2,000 a year in fees, depending upon how big your fund is, from not having it as a super fund. But then you've got the ongoing costs of running a SMSF. And so it does start to, for us, we sort of go, well, at about 300,000, it starts to get pretty even. And once you get above sort of 600,000-ish in your super, it's probably slightly cheaper to go through an SMSF, depending upon how much you're paying for accounting. And so yeah, and so it can be sort of financially better. There are all these extra things that go with having a self-managed super fund, all these extra responsibilities. But yes, there's that sort of three sort of levels of how you should think about your super and how
Well,
customized
as
they can
somebody
be.
who's had a self-managed super fund for years and years and years, you sort of get used to doing the mechanics of it with your accountant. So it's not huge,
Yes.
but you need to find the right accountant, right? Because if you don't have the right accountant, it can be a real pain.
Oh, absolutely. And just to give you an idea of the levels as well, the types of levels you pay. So there's some low cost ones out there who are just very, it's like you're doing your e-tax or like your H&R Block sort of whatever it is, just a very very basic system. You'd probably pay I think about 1300 a year, I think is sort of the ballpark number that you pay in some of those really low service where it's basically well, my numbers come in, they go out and do it and send it back to you. At the other end, I've certainly seen accountants charging like $10,000 or more for people doing to do their self-managed super fund. I'd say the average is probably sort of in the $3,000 to $5,000 range. So it really sort of depends upon what you need in that and what you're prepared to pay for within those. So, but if you're paying more than sort of $3,000 or $4,000, I'd be questioning the relationship and certainly try to work out if am I getting something else there that they're charging me too much on this, but getting it back from cheaper on charging my business or myself or I don't know whatever somewhere else.
So I suppose as we sort of move towards the final part of the conversation, the Nucleus Wealth platform, wealth platform that is there too, is designed specifically to be, I think, more open, transparent, accessible, all of those things. It might be worth having a quick dive into some of the things that you can actually do on the Nucleus Wealth platform.
Yeah, sure. So I might share a quick screen. So this is the idea is basically what we're doing is a wrapper over the top of brokerage sites. So the big or other platforms, depending upon how where you want to access it from, but usually over brokerage sites just because it ends up being cheaper. But the idea is you sort of get your reporting and everything like that. You can manage everything from here in terms of what have you been adding, what's your balance, transactions, fees, all that type of stuff. And then you can go in and manage the portfolio. You can say, look, if I'm set up to have a tactical growth portfolio, but I want to switch out of that and I want to go to, I just want to go back to owning lots of foreign shares, then you can sort of go, yes, this is what it's going to look like. You can change and see the effect of making those changes on your portfolio, what your risk levels are. There's those types of factors where you can look at various allocations within it. And so the idea is that you can manage this part of it from here. You can see all the different shares that you've got. You can go in and look at more details on those shares and say, well, show me why I own this particular share within my portfolio. And look at more details about what they've been doing in recent times, and you can put these screens and exclusions on. Spoken about in the past, where you say, look, this one's going. I don't want any fossil fuels. I don't want any Australian tax dodgers. But you can sort of jump in and go, do I care about the war? So you can sort of, maybe it's a no nuclear weapons, but and then you can add things in as well. So you can say, well then. What do you think about nuclear power? Are you positive, negative on that? You can either include it or exclude it. You can sort of include some, say, clean energy stocks, and then go and sort of see the effect of what that would do on your portfolio. So, because I've chosen no nuclear weapons, I'm not buying RTX Corp, and because I've chosen some no fossil fuels here, the stuff that's stripped out, and then because I've gone in and picked a few more of these different portfolios, I can see, well, there's some extra stocks I'm buying within that portfolio and what that's going to do. So yeah, so that's the sort of overall thing. You can certainly run through some advice types of ones as well, where you can sort of go through and say you'd like to run an age-based strategy, or you want robo advice to sort of go through and answer a bunch of questions about your investment experience and have us recommend the type of risk profile that you should be looking at. So yeah, so that's the type of thing, and we do go into a lot of detail about, performance, and we'll look at the fees within people's funds and try and break down all those levels. So sort of those six levels of different fees we spoke about into the final fees. And I spoke a little bit about saying, well, it's actually each one's different in terms of, am I comparing it to a super fund? Am I comparing it, sorry, comparing it to to growth funds or ETFs, because they've all got different fees that they show and they don't show, and so sometimes you want to make sure you line them up. And then finally, we do a bit of planning, whether you can look at sort of retirement planning or tax checklists of things you should be doing, and what your tax structures are and how they're set up for those types of things. So yeah, that's sort of what we're trying to do, a wrapper over the tops of these ones, and that's without the extra fees. We're not charging an extra fee for this. This is just what we're trying to do across what the platforms are doing, and then trying to provide that extra, I guess the level of knowledge above it. So there's one thing to say, I'm reporting and I'm telling you what's going on, and then there's a second part of like, well, let me sort of modify portfolios, see what the actual effects are going to be, and know, why do you own certain things within it.
And the point there, Damien, is that it depends a little bit on how engaged you want personally to be with regard to your investments, right? Because some people won't want to go into a lot of that a lot of the time. Other people will want to get right into the detail. And so there is a nice gradation there, isn't there, in terms of, you can go as far and as deep as you want to be able to actually take more and more ownership, or you can pull back and say, no, just carry on or whatever, right? So the
Yeah,
flexibility is quite important.
that's that idea that, the word nucleus sort of comes from that idea that, there's a core portfolio, and for some people it's like, you know what, I just want that core portfolio, give me that money, give me the 100% in the core portfolio, I don't want anything in anything else, and just run that for me and keep the fees low. And then there's other people who are like, well, speaking to mining executives, and they're like, well, we make all this money from the companies we're in, we just don't want any more mining exposure, so give me a portfolio, but cut all the miners out, or things like that. And so there's definitely, that ability to customize, I think, is really important for people. And whether it be for an ethical reason that you're like, look, my grandfather died of cancer, I just don't want any smoking stocks, I don't care how much money you can make from them, I just don't want them in my portfolio, versus the, I work for a bank and I don't want that I've got enough shares from working there. I don't need any more in my retirement portfolio. So, yeah.
So as we come to the end of the conversation, Damien, what are the three questions that if I were an investor, I should be asking about my platform?
Yeah, so number one fees, but not just the basic fees. You really want to dig down into the foreign exchange fees, trading, all those types of things like that. So that's your first one. Secondly is go through a live example of okay, I'm gonna come in and I'm gonna buy $100,000. I've got $100,000, I'm gonna invest $100,000. What are my buy sell costs and all that type of stuff like that. And that's interesting and important. So I'm not saying it's not important, that first one, but just as important as, okay, now I've just got $500 worth of dividends, I want to reinvest it. What's my cost at that stage? I think is the next part. So those two parts, and then the third one I'd be looking for is getting down to the reporting that you're actually getting and the systems and that you're comfortable with what it is, because it can be fine to pay a little bit extra to get a reporting system that fits. My accountants tap into it, they grab everything they want, or I can get all the from a dashboard I can see everything I want and manage it all. That might be worth the extra fee. Whereas sometimes you might be paying for a platform that's really handy for your advisor to use, but just a real pain for you, a real pain for your accountant, and that sort of that day-to-day sort of actual access is ends up being not worth what you're paying for it.
Absolutely. So the point I think we want to end on, Damien, is it's not a simple situation here, right? There are lots of different variants of platforms out there. Not all of them work in the same way. Not all of them have the same transparency, nor indeed necessarily the same facilities. Beware of the embedded fees that nobody sees, but actually are degrading the performance of the portfolio. Make sure that it's the right sort of platform for you to be able to do things that you want to do. And I think the final thing I would say is keep an eye on it. Don't just sort of completely set and forget it, right? Because actually things can change.
Well, and actually, one other thing I probably should have said the fourth. I'm going to add a fourth one to you is how do you get out? That's the other one. I got to say, because getting in is always easy. Everyone makes it easy to get your money into your platform. It's when you want to get it out. That can be the issue. And so I'll use the Interactive Brokers, which is one of our main platforms, as a great example. Effectively, we are a it's your account, your stocks. We're just managing it on your behalf. And if you decide you don't like Nucleus anymore, you can jump onto Interactive Brokers and take us off, and you own the shares. That's it. It's all yours. Done. Or you can ask us to sell them all for you, and we can sell them, and you get the cash back. There are platforms out there that'll turn around and go, oh, you want to leave? Okay, now you got to pay all these exit fees, or you got to pay transfer fees, or whatever it is, and it can be thousands of dollars to get off some of these platforms. And sometimes they won't let you transfer the shares, and so while it might not be you might not be paying as much in transfer fees, you're paying a lot in tax just to actually sell them all down and then move it across somewhere else. And so getting out is the other important thing. Make sure that there's a the exit is at least somewhat easy, and it's not, you don't feel as if they're putting the walls up to the reason why they keep their customers is because nobody wants to leave because the fees are so high to get out.
Yeah, and I'll just add one little insight. If you have stuff in joint names, or if you have, like my wife died, right? She had some assets. We had to actually get those transferred. Some other platform owners were very helpful and did it quite quickly. I had one platform. It took a year and a bit, and they were slow and they were unhelpful. They kept putting barriers up, and it was so frustrating. So, when you're thinking about the exit, think about the unfortunate exits as well as perhaps the fortunate ones.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. Yes.
Damien, I found that very interesting, and I'm sure that those following along will do. We'll put links and things below if people want to follow up with you with regards to what Nucleus Wealth does. But thank you very much for taking time today to explain about platforms and why not all platforms are the same.
Thanks a lot, Martin. Catch you next time.
See ya.